Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
The Athletic.
It's very easy for pundits to say Man United ran less than Brentford. What's going on? There's no passion. There's no desire. You know, they roll out all those classic buzzwords, but actually it's a bit more to it than that.
Hello there. This is the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. We're interested in footballing discussions surrounding tactics, analytics, trends, quirks, and trying to better understand the game itself. I'm Ali Maxwell, joined this week by a trio of high-intensity runners. First and foremost, Jay Harris joins us for his pod debut. Hi, Jay.
Yeah, hi, guys. I've got to say, this feels like an international call-up. Do you know what I mean? Like, this coming on the Tactics podcast means I might actually know something about football. So thanks for having me on.
Well, it's been such a strong start to the season. And as anyone who follows the England national team knows, sometimes all it takes is three or four strong games to kick off a campaign. You know, it helps if one or two of them's televised, and all of a sudden, getting the call for the autumn for the first call-ups. Jay, you cover Brentford for The Athletic, and it always strikes me that for someone who's into tactics and or analytics, as we and our listeners are, that must be a bit of a delight journalistically.
Yeah, definitely. I think Brentford are the kind of team where every single week they're trying to do something different. Obviously, watched them draw with Crystal Palace last night, and Zanka, their centre-back, was taking goal kicks instead of David Raya at times. And I asked Thomas Frank after the game, you know, was that a tactical decision? Was that planned? And he said yes. And I said, would you like to tell me why? And he said no. So, but I think it was basically just to force Crystal Palace to push forward, and then they'd give it back to Raya, and he'd clip it over Wilfred Zaha to Aaron Hickey. But it's just those kind of small details that they do, which you don't really see other teams kind of do.
Well, they're so well known for being smart that it must be, in a sense, is it frustrating that even when things don't go well, you sort of think to yourself, well, I know that there's so much logic and so much good decision-making process going into these things that it's difficult to, it must be difficult to put a critical hat on, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think I'm always going to praise them for trying to do things differently, especially with the long throw-ins. You know, you're always going to get some people that hate long throw-ins, and you're always going to get some people that think it should be utilised more. And I think the fact that they got, I think it was two goals from long throw-ins last season. I'm sure if you offered two goals to any football team, they're going to take it. Why not try and do something different? You don't know how it's going to work out. But yeah, fascinating to just watch them week in, week out. I'm obsessed with their corner routines as well. They're just, yeah, so unique.
Mark Carey's here as well with us. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm good, thank you. I've got a lot of ideas running through my head for this week's episode. Little extrapolation.
I thought that was a tattoo reference, but I'm not sure it was. I'll take it either way. Welcome to Liam Tharm as well. All the things you said last week, Liam, I thought were excellent. How are you doing?
Thanks, Ali. Yeah, no, good to be here. You say enough things on Twitter and something sticks eventually, doesn't it? So, yeah, it's good to see there have some used my tweets to someone at least.
Hey, shout out to listener Matthew Kane, who we have to thank for our topic this week. He tweeted us, any chance you guys can do a piece on distance covered? It's become a fashionable metric among pundits for working hard, but surely the team with less possession will always cover more ground. There must be better data to show hard work. Excellent idea, excellent questions, Matthew. So here is our best shot at tackling them. Jay, you did a piece on this recently. It's why you're on with us today. As Matthew says, this season there have already been a few occasions of running stats, and maybe most specifically distance covered, being part of the Premier League conversation. Is it fair to say that this piece came because you weren't buying the narrative being presented?
I think we just got asked to explore it a little bit more and challenge it. I think the trend was kind of kickstarted by that famous 4-0 win that Brentford had over Manchester United. And, you know, Erik ten Hag bringing in the Manchester United players the next day to run 13.8 kilometres that Brentford outran them. So it just generated massive headlines. And before I was coming on to this pod, I was thinking about how, you know, the distance covered blew up quite so quickly. And I almost think Ten Hag bringing the players in to do that almost made it seem as if it was an effort thing, when there's actually a lot more to do in terms of the state of the game and things like that, which I'm sure we'll come on to. Following weekend, Leeds do the same against Chelsea. They outrun them. They win 3-0. And then obviously then Man United reversed it when they beat Liverpool 2-1. So we just thought, what's actually going on here? And the second you start even lightly chipping at the numbers, it becomes pretty obvious, as I think Matthew alluded to, the team that has less possession is always going to do more running for loads of different reasons. So it's something that, you know, it's very easy for pundits to say, Man United ran less than Brentford. What's going on? There's no passion. There's no desire. You know, they roll out all those classic buzzwords. But actually, it's a bit more to it than that.
Mark, one of the things that we take pretty seriously on here is trying to work out stats, data, metrics, if you will, that actually mean something, that can be predictive or can be held up as reasons for things that happened in football matches or for results. And also on the flip side, trying to highlight things that are presented as such, but perhaps only after the fact, only after the result, and are held up sort of conveniently as reasons for it. And this feels like part of that conversation.
With things like, you know, distance covered, it's such an umbrella term where it has so much more nuance to it than just simply who outrun the most. And it's the same with anything in terms of on-ball actions. If you were to use the broad term of possession, we spoke about it before on this podcast. It's just such a broad term. It's what you do with the ball. It's what you do with your running. It's all of the contextual factors that we certainly like to talk about on this podcast. And I think this is where we'll get into the weeds of it within this episode, that to simply say one team outran another is just devoid of context, and that's what we want to try and dig into.
Liam, you've been keen to be a part of this conversation as well. I mean, this season, Leeds and Newcastle are coming up well in terms of distance covered. It seems very early in the season to be reading too much into this sort of data, given how much can impact one, two, three games worth of a sample size. So using data from previous seasons in the Premier League, is there any correlation between distance covered and success?
The short answer is no. I sort of looked at very rudimentarily the numbers from last season and the top teams. This is all from Sky Sports, who I believe use OptiData. And if you go through the top five for distance covered, and this is just total distance, as Mark said, there's no nuance. There's Norwich, who were top. They were relegated. It's Brentford in there, 13th. Burnley relegated. West Ham, 7th. And Man City's the champion. So straight away from the, you know, right from the top, you're looking at a vast array of teams, so there's no real distinguishable pattern. And in the bottom five as well, you've got Palace, Newcastle, United, Chelsea and Villa. So a couple of mid-table teams, you've got Chelsea up there sort of pushing the top. So it's now more of a question that we need to look at this not isolated from technical and tactical performance, but teams are going to play in a way that some teams might demand a higher volume of running, but teams are also going to use running in different ways, because ultimately that's just moving the human body so that you can do different things at different times on a football pitch. Leeds very much get this tied into sort of their style, I think, because they're a very transitional team and I think a very intense team as well. So not only do they run a lot in terms of distance, but a lot at high intensity. It's a lot of sprints when they win the ball back to try and counter-attack. And when they lose it, a lot of sprints likewise to try and press teams. Jay mentioned, I think against Chelsea, about them outrunning Chelsea. They went through a 30-game consecutive streak last season. These were numbers that Joe Donoghue put on Twitter of outrunning opponents from September 2020 to April 21. And within that, I think it's interesting, they had 13 wins, 3 draws, and 14 losses. So again, a split. And it's a case of this isolated metric on its own isn't going to tell us, you know, the outcome of the game, because like any single metric, it's just a frequency count. It's the number of times they've made these runs or they've run this total distance. Likewise, we can't gauge a result from just the number of passes. The only thing we can do it from, obviously, is the number of goals.
Jay, I thought a point that John McKenzie of TIFO made on Twitter was interesting, saying the takeaway shouldn't be that running more makes you more likely to win, but that teams with decent off-ball approaches are getting more joy so far this season. I suppose that Brentford victory, what they did without the ball, was perhaps the key to the game.
Yeah, definitely. I think John hit the nail on the head when he said that. You look at how Brentford kind of approached that game, and if you ever have the pleasure of talking to Thomas Frank, Thomas Frank is like a football purist. He wants to play like prime Barcelona with the tiki-taka and all that types of stuff. But he just recognises that in order to be a successful team at any level, let alone in the Premier League, you need to adapt your approach. So what he was looking at Manchester United was, what's the best way we can hurt this team? And obviously, it was about pressing them so high up the pitch, you know, putting that pressure on Christian Eriksen and Harry Maguire when David De Gea had those goal kicks. And look how effective it was. And United just couldn't really cope up with how much they were getting pressed. You know, there were countless mistakes. And that just shows that if you're running cleverly, it's way more important than running around like headless chickens. That's the kind of key differentiator here. Brentford weren't just running for the sake of it. As one Man United podcast, I won't name names, described it after the game as Brentford play like under nines football. They just run around a lot. That was, you can imagine that didn't go down too well. But the reality was they were just very intelligent with what they did and had a really clear and concise plan, and it worked to a T.
Jay, you actually asked Thomas Frank about the topic of running stats and about that game against United. What was his take on the conversation surrounding that particular metric?
Yeah, you know, as always, he had something quite interesting to say. And he said that, you know, football's such a complex game that there are so many different factors as to why a team might win. And to only look at running is obviously a little bit naive. But he said that, you know, running's a really, really important foundation for teams. Then he also pointed out, which I'm sure is something we can get onto in a moment, that ideally you want to do less running. You know, you want to conserve your energy for those important moments of the game. So he said it's equally important to have players within your team who can retain the ball so you're not losing possession carelessly and making unnecessary sprints and distance, which is quite an interesting thing to make as well.
Liam, what did you make of Ten Hag's punishment, if you will, bringing the players in to run that 13 point something kilometres that was the difference in distance covered between the two teams? You've experienced working within a club, working with sports scientists within clubs. Do you think that a sports science department would consider that conducive to a healthy training regime?
I obviously can't speak on behalf of any sports scientists, so if any of them do disagree with me, then I apologise. But from sort of my limited understanding, it's probably not the best thing to do the first day, or sort of match day plus one, if you want to use those terms, the day after a game. Players are often, you know, doing recovery-based things, particularly when you've got a condensed fixture schedule like this. And there's been a lot of talk about players being in the red zone, quote-unquote, whatever that might look like for them. And more than ever, being conscious then of player well-being. It does seem a strange approach, but at the end of the day, that's the sports scientist not being the top of the hierarchy. The head coach slash manager makes the call. And from my experience, really, when I was at Brighton in the academy, again, this is not first team level, so it might be different. But fundamentally, those physical stats which were used, again, things like distance covered or high intensity, sprints, details like that, a lot more for physically tracking players and seeing what their loading was like across a game, because then it's used to sort of tailor training and say, oh, okay, this player's covered a lot of distance, or they've ran really hard. They're going to need to maybe have a sort of a reduced or an adapted training session. They might miss out on a drill or on a practice. And likewise, players that maybe haven't covered too much, maybe come on as a sub, they might need an additional top up. And it's just trying to keep players basically ticking over, which is why you often see players at the end of a match with a sports scientist, the unused subs, doing sprints along the pitch because they need to get in that fatigue almost to keep themselves ticking over.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, we love confirmation bias on this podcast. So at the very least, we can say it worked, because look how much they ran in that win against Liverpool. So can we say, Liam, Mark, Jay, you can all have a stab at this if you like. Can we say with quite a lot of confidence that distance covered, that stat, does not reflect effort expended, as is the way that it's often presented, as much as style of play and game state we probably have to bring up at this point as well, Liam?
Yeah, I'd say so. That's going to massively impact all forms of performance, not just physically, but how teams do things technically. Often teams, when they score or go 1-0 up, will change their approach. I think a big thing to consider with United in particular against Liverpool was how their sort of possession approach changed. They very much sat in shape and sort of their mid-block and were just sort of sliding left and right, at least for the first sort of 20, 25 minutes. And their chances and sort of their second goal in particular came from those fast breaks. So if you're not going to press a team too much, you're going to do less running out of possession. And as we mentioned about conserving energy, it then meant the likes of Rashford, those key players that could be those direct straight line runners, when they did get the ball back, could then play early. So it's again considering how those sort of interact there. And I think it's just slightly maybe old-fashioned, I apologize if anyone thinks that's slightly offensive, but just to consider the idea that, you know, you can't always mitigate or control for opposition quality, but you might be able to guarantee that you can outrun them. Mm-hmm. So for me to see it, the idea of just working hard is a bit redundant and maybe loses the bigger picture of things.
I think as well for me, it's two things. One is that I'll always come back to the idea of sample size, and the fact that we're talking about things on a one game basis. When we're obviously talking about the example of the Brentford Manchester United game, etc., looking at things on a one game basis isn't conducive to really understanding how a team operates. And the second thing is that it's not too conducive to looking at success. And a lot of the metrics and the stats that we look at aren't necessarily looking at things in terms of better or worse, but it's more maybe more or less. So maybe looking to see how the approach is across a larger sample size. So to sort of suggest that, coming back full circle to what we're talking about, that less is also worse, that isn't necessarily the case. It's just stylistically it's something that's different. And you'll see it again, for example, Leeds last season top of all of the sprinting list, the distance covered list. It doesn't indicate success, just indicates that stylistically under Bielsa and Marsh they're a team who are very well set up to get through a lot of physical performance. So not better or worse, just different.
It's not hard to see how, with the players, every move being measured now with those GPS vests that they wear, how players could take pride in their running stats and be so aware of them, because there's, I guess, nowhere to hide, if you will. But Jay, your article brought up something that really interested me. I'm calling it the Rob Huth theory. not all players are looking to rack up their running stats.
No, not at all. So I spoke to Chris Barnes, who's a sports scientist. He's worked at quite a few Premier League clubs throughout his career. You know, he's worked with Steve McClaren, Tony Pulis, Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank. And I think it was whilst he was at Middlesbrough, he worked with Robert Huth, and basically said Robert Huth was one of those players, which I love, who was just obsessed with his kind of statistics. You know, after a game, he'd be, you know, bugging the sports science department saying, what have I done here? What have I done there? What have I done? And basically Robert Huth's perspective on it was, the less work I've done in a game, the better I've played, because, you know, it means I've made better decisions, which means I've not had to, you know, expend too much energy. And as soon as I heard that, it obviously reminded me of the you know, Paolo Maldini's quotes about how if I've made a tackle, I've already made a mistake. And I thought it was a really intelligent way of looking at it. You know, if your body positioning's always correct, so you don't have to run, you don't have to make a tackle, you don't have to make an interception or a clearance, you know, you're just preventing the opposition from progressing as a defender, then that's great work. So it was. It really did crack me up. And I'm sure Robert Huth won't mind me shouting him out for this. But someone tagged me in a tweet and kind of commented on Robert Huth saying that. And Robert Huth liked it on Twitter. So, you know, he's he's clearly still aware of what people are saying about him. So that it did make me chuckle that.
Well, hopefully he's delighted that he's been given his own theory, particularly because, Mark, there's probably another name that can be mentioned in this sort of discussion, and that's Lionel Messi, who really did make the most of standing still and creating space in that way, letting the recycling of possession around him and the movement of his teammates at Barcelona help create or pull defenders out of position and create pockets of space for Messi to do the damage that way. And this is part of the discussion, Mark, about running more versus running better, and in doing so, conserving energy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like anything in football, is playing with game intelligence and being smart with your actions rather than necessarily going for high volume. And I suppose you know better than me, Ali, in terms of the EFL. So Swansea City, quite a key example in terms of just how much Russell Martin likes his teams to play, obviously, high possession side, but they don't necessarily match that with maybe how much they create. And when we think about it from a running perspective, I think running better is thinking of the intelligent off-ball runs when your team is in possession, which just kind of alludes to what Liam said before, and finding space to exploit in behind in terms of those off-ball runs in possession, out of possession, thinking about the intelligent pressing in terms of arcing the run, maybe blocking passing lanes and things like that. So, you know, I think the Lionel Messi example is a really good one, because he has such a world-class appreciation of space that it isn't necessarily about the whole running more. It's really about that conserving energy, especially throughout his career, but having that intelligence, the game intelligence tactically, but also physically, to maximize your own performance. And if we're talking about Lionel Messi, it's not running that much, talking about someone who's historically been the best in the world. And I think it highlights even more that this can't be a reliable metric to assess performance, especially at the player level.
Just to add on to what Mark was saying there about sort of sprinting and how Messi's, you know, very good actually at walking around and picking his moments, you need to massively consider how sort of repeated sprinting works and how fatigue works, that if players are constantly trying to go for 30, 40 yard sprints at high intensity all the time and frequently, they're going to blow up and, you know, be exhausted early on. And that might be more okay this season with more subs, but to repeatedly every sort of game week just isn't possible. I think Neil Maupay, when he was at Brighton, and I'm now looking forward to seeing how he does that at Everton, was a great example of sort of timing your sprints, particularly for players who have speed as sort of a real fundamental to their games. If you look at Alisson Maximan, people might go, oh, he's walking a lot, but he's going to go at such high intensity that he's going to need 3-4 minutes, maybe 5 minutes between a sprint to recover, to set himself, because he just can't go for a full 90 minutes. And it's then just having that appreciation that to keep the quality of these sprints, you know, there needs to be time between.
It definitely leads me to adding even more appreciation to players at the top level who, on top of everything that they have to think about, nowadays have to be incredibly well aligned and in tune with their physical output, what it means for their performance. And that balance between conserving energy and therefore maybe not pressing at all times versus not wanting to be seen to be playing in a lazy manner must be quite a difficult balance to strike at times. There's a quote from Jamie Vardy in Warville's piece on this topic on The Athletic from early 2021 saying, I used to basically sprint from right back to left back and back across again, and it was just burning up energy for no reason. It's about keeping that energy and that mindset so you're ready to fully go 100% when you know there is a chance to win the ball, rather than trying to do that when there is a 10% chance of winning the ball. And that's what it's all about. This is the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. We are not done with this discussion. Next, we're going to try and find out which metrics have a better correlation to performance or success. Join us for part two.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman, and we finally reached the closing week of the summer transfer window. Premier League clubs have spent more than their German, Italian, Spanish and French counterparts combined, and they are not done yet. Don't miss any of the twists and turns with myself, David Ornstein, Adam Crafton and many more on the Athletic Football Podcast this week as we take you inside the deals that really matter. We're free to listen wherever you get your podcasts, and we're ad-free on the Athletic app.
Okay, Liam, you've dug deep and read some of the academic research that's been done on the topic of running stats. A lot of very smart people trying to find correlation, trying to find relationships between certain metrics within running data and performances or results. What have people discovered and found?
Yeah, thankfully, there's a lot of clever people, as you say, that have done a lot of the hard work for me that allows me to just sift through some of these papers. There's a couple of good ones that looked at the Bundesliga. I'll sort of caveat this immediately with they're slightly dated. So they're sort of one of them's towards the late sort of 2000s, so around 2010. And one looks at between the 2011-12 season and 2016-17, which is on the academic side, one of their problems that a lot of people that do the research can't always get access to sort of modern data. But these are the best things that we have academically. I was interested to see that the sort of longitudinal study found that there was a 77% prediction rate for running performance on actually scoring the first goal. And the total distance predicted this better than sort of high speed running, which might, I think, maybe perhaps make a bit of sense. Again, interested to get your guys' opinions on this, but I think it maybe ties into starting a game quickly and trying to press intensely, definitely pin the opposition back. I think United against Liverpool was a great example of that. You know, I think the co-commentators on Sky always love saying, you know, a team's not being allowed to settle, that they're, you know, really under it early on. But linking back to the Vardy point as well, one of the other papers that I looked at found that 45% of goals were scored following a straight line sprint by the goal scorer, which was the most frequent action, which again, I think, puts a number on something that makes a lot of sense. You know, these fast runs to attack crosses or to get on the end of through balls. And so again, it's about, as Mark was saying, contextualising what the running looks like.
Jay, that's interesting, isn't it? Because the impact of running performance on the first goal rather than total result, I think, kind of makes sense. And it ties into things that fans talk about, which aren't, in their eyes, analytical or data-driven at all. Things like still being on the bus, things like flying out the traps. And, it, you know, these are the sorts of things that we think we can see with our eyes when we're watching a game at times.
Or the classic, you know, you've got to win your first duel. You've got to win your first duel.
Yeah.
No, so, you know what? I find that academic research really, really, really fascinating. And just going back to actually the Vardy stuff and about the straight line sprinting, I spoke to Leanne Sanderson for the piece, and she was talking about how during her time in with England, she would come off games sometimes thinking, oh, you know, I've not played particularly well. And then the sports scientist would turn around and say, oh no, you know, your running stats are amazing, like, well done, well done. But it's not about just running constantly, as Vardy kind of alluded to. It's about conserving your energy to make the right runs. And as a striker, kind of assessing the game to say, I've got an opportunity to score a goal here, and saving yourself for those runs into the box to attack a ball. So that's quite interesting. But yeah, to the first duel stuff, that's absolutely hilarious. You know, there are probably people listening to this who are like rubbing their hands with glee, and you know, they're going to say, well, actually, according to this study, it actually does have quite an impact, you know, if your team's not on the bus or isn't settling straight away. But I don't think I could put it much better than what Liam said, to be honest.
You mentioned, Liam, that within the academy system at Brighton, where you worked, who no doubt have a high level of data used throughout the club and people to interpret it, you mentioned that these sorts of stats, metrics, distance covered, sprinting stats were used to, in terms of player loading, kind of sports science and physical performance. Was there any way in which the sort of physical data was used to help sculpt tactical or match strategy decisions?
Not massively from memory, but I think that's more of a football-wide thing. And one of the areas definitely where I think we can make inroads now analytically to sort of integrate this data a lot better. I think we've seen a great example is how we've moved from, say, shots to XG, now looking at these factors that are going to, on the, you know, in relation to things on the pitch, where things are, and the in relation to the opposition, you know, these more multidimensional variables that consider a lot more things. And again, if you could start to consider perhaps the run type, whether it's an in and out or in possession, sorry, or an out of possession run, the position that the player is making, and then, you know, you start to build up these profiles of players or these profiles of teams. You can see moments in the game when they are or aren't sprinting. I think that would be a lot more valuable, and that would actually help, I think, particularly from a recruitment standpoint. If you look at someone, a team like Leeds, for instance, I'm going to use them as an example once more. If they're a heavily predicated team on running, then it's going to make sense not only to assess players tactically and build a profile for them technically with their data reports, but also to see what they need, at least better, like physically.
That makes me think of that Warville piece once again, because he had some incredible charts and graphs which mapped out individual players and their running stats more broadly, but broken down into the way in which they covered ground. And you could see very clearly how differently two players, even within the same position, could cover essentially the same total distance. So I remember Oriol Romeu and Harrison Reed both covered very similar distances per game, but in completely opposite ways. Romeu was basically motoring around in like second gear without barely ever stopping, whereas Reed was all about short bursts. And, you know, it's very similar with Harry Kane and Rafinha. I think they had almost equivalent distances covered per games. But you think about Kane and Rafinha, you know, again, couldn't be more different really in terms of the way in which they cover it. So that's really interesting. And, you know, unfortunately for laymen like me, difficult stuff to access regularly to have that sort of breakdown. Just one more question about your work at Brighton. I'm interested to know, within academy players, for example, which is what you were working with, are there big differences between the sorts of distances academy players can cover in a game or in their capacity for sprints and high intensity runs? Like, we're talking about essentially elite players of their age group. Are there still big gaps between what players can do in that environment?
I'd say more so than at first team level, because biological maturity really comes into play. So you might get a really big 13-year-old who might actually be the size of an average 15-year-old, but obviously is chronologically born in the year that makes them actually sort of 13. And similarly, you can get some really small players biologically for their age, and that will of course have a massive impact. And at academy level, requires you to constantly be critical, and it's a reason why players are constantly assessed in terms of their physical performance. So every academy, the Premier League come in and they actually run sort of a battery really of different tests in terms of sprints. They're all sort of very scientific and very prescriptive. So it's, I think there's a straight line sprint that they do over a couple of distances. There's some jumps that they do, but this allows for, you know, consistent tracking of performance over time, and then gives you an indication, you know, relative to all the other metrics you pull together, you get a bigger sort of look at the jigsaw of a player, if you like.
So you get a really quick idea of which players, for example, come back from their summer break and have, you know, massively matured physically and can now, you know, in theory, do more things on a football pitch if they can cover ground quicker. That's really interesting. A few final things that when, you know, reading Jay's piece and Warville's piece and chatting to you guys about this in preparation of the pod, some things I've been wondering about. Mark, I'll come to you. Can we break this down per positions? Like, talking about tactics, is there one position on the pitch in general that runs more than one another? Does a central midfielder cover more distance in a game than your average wing back, for example?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, you said it before in terms of how much variation there is within a position, never mind between positions. But it is still interesting, kind of broadly speaking, that, again, it is where context is key when looking at those total team distances covered. But yeah, I think central midfielders are more about endurance, making sure that they do cover a lot of ground. And the likes of wing backs and full backs are more to do with intensity. So obviously the type of running does come into it. And I looked at a few research papers as well. You're not the only one, Liam. I read a 2019 paper on this topic this week, and they basically found that players on average ran approximately 10.3 kilometers per game, but central defenders ran the least of any position on the pitch and central midfielders ran the most. And then they split it into running types, and wide midfielders and fullbacks covered the most sprinting distance in meters, again, per game. And wide midfielders and forwards had the highest count of high intensity accelerations, so akin to sprinting in terms of that sort of intensity. So again, yeah, as you say, Ali, very much positionally dependent on the type of running, which, yeah, again, makes those final distance tallies so devoid of context.
Here's a tactical question for you, Liam. Do you think a central centre-back in a back three system would run less than a centre-back in a back four system?
Probably. I'd imagine those teams that adopt a back three to be a bit more sort of expansive and maybe a bit more pressing. But I think the type would change as well. They'd probably do a lot more going into the wings, so a lot more sort of sideways movement. You know, to generalise football people, when they talk about a centre defender, they hate being pulled out into the wide areas and sort of going 1v1. So I imagine they'd have a lot more to do in that regard. But we've seen in recent seasons as well, sort of those outside central defenders like to make those sort of forward runs, those overlaps. So I guess that sort of shape facilitates players that can do that. So it'd be interesting to see now if managers maybe start to work on not only maximising the technical, but also the physical capabilities of players in that regard. So, you know, I think it's something we massively overlook in terms of, we often discuss what a player can do in possession, out of possession, but very rarely about their sort of physical output capabilities, aside from the, you know, the ridiculously fast sprinters in the league.
Another thing I was wondering about, Mark, is, do we think there's a big difference in distance covered by an average of all the Premier League teams versus the other top five leagues in France, Serie A in Italy, Germany, Spain, you know, even League Two, the fourth tier in English football? What would be the difference, do you think, between those leagues?
Yeah, this is an interesting one. I don't necessarily know about sort of lower down the English leagues, but there was a piece of analysis done by Skill Corner on this, and it was a couple of years ago now, but they looked at the top five European leagues. And Skill Corner, great company, they use broadcast tracking to measure physical data at the player level, and obviously you can look at it at the team level and consequently the league level. And they basically looked at which league is the most physically demanding, and they analysed it across three different categories of physical performance. So intensity, sprinting, and volume. So I suppose total distance there. So interestingly and unsurprisingly, the Premier League was the highest for the intensity of running and the sprinting when looking at both the count and the total distance of these run types. But interestingly, the Serie A and La Liga were the highest, higher than the Premier League in terms of the total distance covered, which I thought was interesting. So obviously broken down by the intensity, Premier League come out on top, but looking at the average total, Serie A and La Liga were up there, but clearly maybe at a lower intensity.
I wonder if they have a higher ball in play time. That's the sort of thing that would have an impact on this. Jay, how much do you think these average distances and numbers will have increased over the last decade? From the eye test, it feels like, just taking the Premier League, you know, the base level of physicality needed to be a Premier League player now just seems insane compared to even 10 years ago.
Yeah, you'd think they would have massively changed over the last 10 years. To throw it even further back, it'd be fascinating. I'm sure the data probably doesn't exist, to see what the numbers are like compared to when the Premier League first started 30 years ago. But I just think, you know, the more technology we get, and the more, you know, sports science develops, the more there becomes a focus on this type of thing. What I found quite interesting covering a club over the last year or so is how much of a focus Brentford have on when they sign a new player, about not throwing them in straight away and getting them to kind of build them up to what they consider to be like prime physicality. So obviously, let's take Mikael Damsgaard as a case study, because, you know, everybody kind of remembers him from when he scored against England in the Euro semi-finals last year. And Brentford have been really, really gentle with him at the moment to kind of integrate him into the Premier League. He's not started in the game yet. And the reason for that is, you know, he's not on our level of physicality yet. He might have been, when he was in Sampdoria, on their level of physicality, but according to how we want to play as a Premier League team, we still need to build him up. So I find that quite interesting, that even across different teams who obviously have different approaches, they've got different ideas on what the perfect kind of physical condition of a player looks like.
Mark, it plays into recruitment questions, doesn't it? You know, you're signing players from a different league. We're always trying to work out how you can get better at predicting which players will adapt to the rigours, shall we say, of the Premier League. This is more or less going to be one of the key factors in that, and working out how a player's physical data will translate and cope with the Premier League.
Yeah, completely. I did a piece on that with Stu James fairly recently, in terms of that adaptation between leagues. And I guess it feeds into what I was saying before about that difference in not only the distance, but the intensity of the running. But there's so many different things that come into it. Jay's example with Damsgaard's a really interesting one, that it's the physical side, it's the tactical side, it's the stylistic side. You know, you look at each league across Europe, or, you know, globally, that there's maybe more of an attritional league in terms of fewer goals per game. So you have to make that translation between a player's metrics from one season or one league to another. There's maybe leagues that are more aerially dominant. So you think about physical performance, obviously, in terms of running, but physicality in terms of strength and being able to compete in aerial duels, Premier League is often quite higher than most leagues in that regard. So it's so much to be said about an adaptation period. Physical performance in terms of running is one of them. But I think it's becoming more and more common. I know that Liverpool do the same. More and more common to have that adaptation period over a period of weeks and months before really embedding and integrating the player into the new team.
I'm going to be keeping a very close eye on which deadline day signings are chucked straight into the first 11, completely thoughtlessly and potentially sort of throwing them in at the deep end versus shock horror, the Brentford careful, forward planning, thoughtful approach to best get good performances. Not much more on this, but I think we should bring up the question of the broadcast and how how they use running stats on a broadcast. Because, of course, you know, a part of this discussion came from post-match breakdowns of individual games, such as Brentford 4, Manchester United 0. I think we've all got a pretty good appreciation of how difficult it is to use numbers quickly post-game to understand which ones have really mattered. And I think we can probably all appreciate how difficult it is to then present them coherently on a live broadcast within a matter of minutes. So understanding that, how would you, Mark, like to see them handle this on a live broadcast? What extra context do you think pundits and presenters should be acknowledging in order to basically better analyse running, to work out who's running smarter as well as just further?
Yeah, you're right in terms of, before I answer, I don't want to sit too much on my high horse of saying that they should do things better, you know, but it's difficult. I think with all, yeah, performance data, all data and analytics, I rarely want it to be used as a throwaway statistic, but obviously to have it embedded and discussed within context. So in a perfect world, I'd like to see it maybe broken down to in and out of possession, as Liam alluded to earlier. Again, thinking about this in a perfect world, and as we mentioned before, a lot of it would be purely stylistic too, but something like maybe sprints made per minute out of possession. So it would really try and get a bit of a leveler, equal playing field of how much sprinting a team is doing, purely looking at it stylistically. That would also maybe surround things in more context. Maybe even as well the location of those high intensity sprints. So look to see, again, you think about things like high turnovers, it's potentially a proxy for that, of just how, yeah, a higher team is making those actions and whether it then informs their stylistic profile.
Yeah, I think just to pick up off the back of that, I saw a nice graphic from Stats Perform that showed Kai Havertz off ball runs. I think this is in the first two game weeks, but it's sort of akin to what Mark was saying, and it then visualises and actually brings to life quite nicely when you can use, obviously, the detail on where the runs on the pitch are starting, where they're ending. You unfortunately haven't got the context where the defenders might be and what the actual game situation is, but it's just one way that you can obviously use data visualization to start to identify patterns, identify trends. So I think that way, you know, a nice graphic to see that. Or again, maybe sort of even comparisons to what player or team averages are. So I don't know, maybe Brentford regularly outrun their opponents and maybe them outrunning Manchester United, you know, isn't actually a big deal when you compare it to what the norm is. So yeah, something to, some form of context to compare it to.
I was just going to say exactly that. Everybody I spoke to for the piece said, especially when it's a result that's quite unexpected, like Brentford and Man United, the default and easy narrative is to say, oh, it's an effort thing. That's why they covered less distance. And it's just so important to kind of actually explain, especially in that game, what Brentford's tactics were, what they are trying to do, why that was the case. You know, Manchester United have more possession, Brentford running off the ball more, et cetera, et cetera. Don't just kind of throw it out there as a little bit of a lazy catch-all term. Just maybe take a little bit of a step back and say, okay, what was going on here? But again, any broadcasters listening, I'm not telling you how to do your job. I'm sure if I was in that scenario, I'd probably default to that answer as well.
Jay, you're going to be invited on Super Sunday this weekend. Yeah. Like when Harry Redknapp pulled the fan out of the crowd in the pre-season friendly, stuck him in at West Hampshire. Look, guys, wouldn't it be nice if we could measure hard work? Matthew Kane's last question in his tweet to us was, there must be better data to show hard work. Mark, that feels difficult.
I mean, almost impossible. And I know that I'm always one to just bring things back down to sort of the hard, cold fact, but it must be, it's surely a stylistic thing. You can't show hard work with just purely running. I mean, yeah, Jose Mourinho's version of hard work is going to be wholly different from Jurgen Klopp's, wholly different from Jesse Marsh's, from Thomas Frank's, etc. I think that it would have to be kind of, the idea of hard work would have to be bespoke to a club's game model of basically almost how much you are executing the manager's plans across the pitch, which is going to obviously vary, you know, from team to team, from club to club. So style is obviously going to be so key to how a manager wants their team to play. So basically, I don't think there's going to be a standardised measure of hard work per 90 anytime soon. Far from it.
I was going to say, to play devil's advocate, what do we all consider to be hard work? Is it running 40 yards to make a tackle on the other side of the pitch? Or is it having the intelligence to hold your position and make a, you know, an interception a few yards away when the ball comes to you? It's impossible to answer. All I know is that the next time I play a seven-a-side and I don't make a run, I'm going to tell someone. No, it's not about how much I'm running. It's about the quality of my runs.
I'm obsessed with the idea of there being fans in the stadiums who have always clapped the striker that blocks the ball down the line from the fullback out for a throw-in as like that is passion personified, and we love it. I love the idea that we might now see a growing number of people sort of tutting and shaking their head and saying, mate, that just means you're not going to be able to get across the centre-back when the ball comes in 2 minutes' time. That's what it's all about. That's why we have these conversations. Thank you so much to Jay, to Mark and to Liam for joining me for it. Of course, The Athletic is the best place to go and read all of this good stuff. Jay on Brentford and more, Mark's analytics, Liam's thoughtful tactical pieces as well. For an annual subscription with the best offer right now, head to theathletic.com/tactics. Otherwise, just join us again next week. Make sure you're subscribed to this podcast feed. Check out the other excellent offerings within the Athletic Podcast Network. And if you, like Matthew Kane, have any requests for future topics, let us know. Anything you'd like to see myth busted or attempted myth busting, just tweet us or leave us a comment on the Athletic app. And that's it from us for this week. Goodbye.
The Athletic.